I'm Chris McQueer, writer and spoken word performer. Now in this film, I'm going to tackle a subject that might just take all us Scots right out of our comfort zone. I'm going to be looking into our relationship with our greatest rivals, closest neighbours, and sometimes dearest friends, the English. I grew up in a scheme here in the East End of Glasgow, and at times the English didn't feel so much like people from a different country. They felt like a different species. I don't think I saw an English person until I was about 15. I have to admit that at times in my life I felt quite anti-English. No, especially during the 2014 referendum. I saw the English as everything that was wrong with the world. Do you know what I mean? Do we define ourselves too much based on how we see our bigger neighbour? Can we speak about being Scottish without mentioning the English? Or are we forever doomed to be old enemies? Now I'm determined to get to the bottom of this. What is the truth about the relationship between the Scots and the English?
BBC Scotland. Let's talk about the English. Now a bird's eye view of the bayside town of Berwick on the east coast of Scotland.
I'm Scottish. I'm English. But what if you're neither? Here in Berwick, you hear both. You're probably just as likely to hear somebody say that they're a Berwicker. This is England's most northerly town. The place has changed hands between Scotland and England an incredible 13 times.
The battle over Berwick's national identity has already been fought to a draw down the centuries. The townspeople resolved the identity problem by simply becoming Berwickers, and that allowed them a certain detachment as the armed might of England and Scotland played tug-of-war with the border.
You can see the evidence of this complicated identity everywhere you look here. On the one hand, you've got the museum celebrating the King's Own Scottish Borders Infantry Regiment. But then on the other, you've got the great Coven fortified walls built by Queen Elizabeth I to keep us unruly Scots out.
Chris is taking a stroll along one of the sea walls.
It's a bit of a touchy subject, one that can really get the hackles up. Your relationship with them across the border has been defined by years of history, prejudice, grudges, and even though it fit by much.
A local stadium lies empty in the middle of the day.
It's hard not to talk about football right at the very beginning of this film, seeing as the game and one event in particular helped shape some of my earliest thoughts and ideas about the English.
You can smash them now. Beckham has scored for England. David Beckham puts England in front against Argentina in Sapporo.
During the run-up to the 2002 World Cup, obviously Scotland didn't qualify, but England did. And I quite liked watching English football. I liked like Sir Paul Scholes and David Beckham and all that. So I kind of mentioned this to my ma and my granny and granda. You know, I'm quite keen to see England do well. And immediately they were just like, what? You should want them to get beat. So then all of a sudden I started hearing all these mad stereotypes about the English. My family telling me that, oh, the English, they're all loud. They're all arrogant. They're all rude. They're all untidy. Once I got kind of swept up in this anti-English sentiment, I remember hoping that England would get beat. And I just think, you know, why was I thinking like that? Why did I not just think for myself?
Shielfield is home to the Wee Rangers of the 2nd Division. The ground has seen better days, but improvements are underway as the team march on towards promotion to the 1st Division.
I've come to Berwick Rangers FC, the only English club to play in Scotland, to meet some lifelong fans and discuss the club's unique identity.
How's it doing, boys? All right?
Fine. Not bad.
Thanks very much, boys, for coming to talk to me today.
How do you see yourselves? Are you Scottish, English? Are you a Borderer? Are you a Berwicker?
Berwick, first and foremost, I think, because there's such a mix of the two countries that it's sort of like, yeah, you've got like an affinity with both of them, basically.
I'll always look at myself as being English, to be honest with you. Aye. But as far as football goes, Berwick, it's got to be Scotland. It's never been nothing else for me. So,
what's your connection to Berwick?
playing for them from 1970 mm-hmm. to 89. Mm-hmm. I think the days when I played, some of the fans would give you a stick, shouting you English so-and-sos. little did they know that I was the only English player in the team, and all the lads came from Edinburgh and Fife and Glasgow.
So see, in terms of geography, where do you think the town itself stands, with Scottish or English?
I think it's got to be English. It can't be anything else because the border's another 3 mile up the road, isn't it? So
I would argue that it's in Scotland because if you take the physical geography, the river is the border and it sort of like jogs around Berwick, so...
I think there is a big divide in the town. Like, you know, people wanted to be Scottish, but other people wanted to be English.
You know, years ago when the pub shut in Berwick, people used to go to Scotland because they were open on a Sunday.
Ah, you get the best of both worlds, really. Mm-hmm.
So what memories of yours go are Scotland and England games?
Great memories. I think that's the difference for me. I'd rather watch Scotland. Yeah. There's more passion. It's a totally different experience, I think, to watching England.
It's good to hear you say that. Like, it's good to hear English people saying that you're watching Scotland.
I was sitting with my two boys on the couch, and when the penalty was saved, we're all going, you know. Behind Scotland, really.
Do you think Scottish people think about the rivalry between Scotland and England more than English people?
Definitely. 300%. We are sitting here saying that if Scotland playing, you know, I want them to win. But I don't think the Scottish fans do that with England.
No,
do
they? No.
We don't, no.
Do you know what I mean? My brother used to be one. He'd say, who do you want to win? He'll say, every team that's playing England.
See, in terms of, like, Scottish people having anti-English sentiment, why do you think it comes out so much in football?
Probably in the fact that there is an apathy from Westminster towards the north in general. So there's probably an element of that does impact on Scottish people or Scottish men's sort of relationship with England.
Aye, I think so. We just assume it's our hard border. There's us Scots and then you go on the border and then everybody's just a really posh Tory. But it's not like it.
Later, Chris is standing on the pitch by himself.
Talking to the guys, I was quite glad to hear that they haven't experienced any anti-English sentiment that's went too far. You know, it's kind of been restricted to banter, which I find quite interesting. I thought they hated us as much as we hate them, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
From an overhead view of the empty football pitch to aerial views of the town of Berwick.
Throughout the centuries, thousands of us Scots have felt the need to leave these shores in search of work and a better quality of life abroad. But we are not the only ones on the move. Recent figures show that today there are about 400,000 English folk living here in Scotland. I'm on my way to visit a recent newbie who's made the move from England to the rolling border landscapes of Dumfriesshire, Caroline Morley.
Archie, come on.
Caroline's a leadership development coach who works with global clients. Her job meant commuting into London, but 2 years ago she put the horse in the horse box and made the life-changing decision to up sticks from the south of England and make a new home here.
Good boy. You do your tail. Make you look gorgeous.
I think it's time for a wee bit of honesty here. What do we really think when an English person moves up here to Scotland? Especially if we view them as a posh southerner. Does that plummy accent really get to us? I'm quite keen to find out for Caroline here how she's been welcomed into the local community, or did they just see her as this kind of alien Londoner?
Hello.
Good to see you. How
Come
you doing?
On in.
Thank you.
So with your English accent, have you ever kind of experienced any animosity or anything?
Not overtly.
No.
But there's a sense of it, and I'm very conscious of it. Mm-hmm. So living here, and because I'm close to the border, there is quite a mix of English and Scottish families around here. And nothing annoys me more from the Scottish side as well as from the English side is people living through stereotypes, that they hear my accent and they assume all sorts of things about me. But equally, you know, the whole ginger hair, kilt wearing, blue face painted kind of stereotypes is just, it drives me nuts.
So can I ask a bit about your family history? What's your connection to Scotland?
My father was born and raised, well, he was born actually in Peterhead. And then the family moved to Glasgow. He started off as an apprentice welder, but then decided to join the Air Force. He went to study to become an officer, and he was the chief engineering officer for the Queen's Planes. And if the Queen was travelling anywhere, then there needed to be an engineering officer who was going wherever she was going to make sure that the plane was good enough to get her back.
Mm-hmm. So your dad sounds like he was really successful, you know, coming from really humble beginnings to go into this really glittering career. What a life.
So that's him in his full military glory.
Oh, look at him.
It seemed like everybody's dad did that. Everybody's dad went to Royal Ascot and went to the Royal Enclosure. And everybody's dad got to go on the Royal Yacht.
Aye.
But it's only now, looking back on it, and all that history, that I realised, wow, he was quite important.
He was a big deal.
Right? Yeah, he was, and he loved it.
Did your dad feel a kind of pressure to leave Scotland, do you think?
His dad was a baker. His mum was a housewife. And whilst they, you know, provided for their family, I think he saw that there were very few opportunities in, like, the late 1940s, early 50s, that Scotland could hold for him, so he took his career elsewhere.
I think we... people of a certain generation, their kind of idea of success when you're Scottish is to do well enough to leave Scotland.
Yeah.
What would your dad actually, what would he have thought of Scotland, maybe leaving the Union?
He wouldn't have approved.
No.
He had the kilt and he was very, very proud of his Scottish heritage. Mm-hmm. But I think from a political point of view, he saw the strength in the UK as a whole entity. Mm-hmm. His politics and mine are very different. Mm-hmm. And I certainly see the strength in Scotland as an independent nation now. Mm-hmm. But I can see why he wouldn't think so, based on his view of Scotland.
Caroline, you're half Scottish, half English. What do you feel more?
I've never described myself as English. It's always been I'm half Scottish. And this feels like where I'm supposed to be.
And when you told your dad you were moving back to Scotland, what was his thoughts on that?
I think he was quietly proud of it.
Aye.
And one of the last times I saw my dad, he squirreled off and up to his bedroom and came back with four of these jumpers. And he said, you'll need those because it's cold in Scotland. Oh. And I've still got them and I wear them. Yeah. And it's a nice way to remember him. So,
that's really nice.
Yeah.
A trio of sheep is grazing in the field outside Caroline's cottage.
That was really interesting hearing Caroline's family history. I love hearing the stuff about her dad, you know. I think it's a really unique perspective hearing the story of a proud Scotsman who moved away and that was some kind of done with the place almost, you know, but still retaining that deep affinity for Scotland.
Ailsa Henderson, Professor of Political Science at Edinburgh University.
It's certainly the case that Scottish identity has been stronger in Scotland than English identity has been in England for a very long time. So a far larger proportion of the Scottish electorate describe themselves as Scottish and have a strong Scottish national identity. And the other thing that's different about Scottish national identity is not just so many people use it as a label, but it's so strong compared to British identity. So the sense of British identity is markedly weaker in Scotland. Whereas in England, you still have a fairly significant proportion of the population that feel both English and British.
Welcome, Imperial Master! From right across the United Kingdom, we are proud to say no.
On the 18th of September 2014, Scotland went to the polls to decide if it would finally become an independent nation.
We are a peaceful country and we don't want to be ruled by the English!
Looking back at the news footage, I'm reminded of just how passionate, and some would say divisive, the debate was on both sides of the argument. Whilst the Yes campaign made their case for independence in Scotland, even Gretna, on the English-Scottish border, one of the most pro-union campaigners, Penrith and the border MP Rory Stewart, decided to launch his own defence of the Union.
Rory Stewart is behind the idea, which aims to highlight the friendship between England and Scotland. Here at the westernmost point of Scotland's border with England, the cairn is growing day by day.
The old acquaintance cairn was built as a lasting symbol of unity and support for Scotland's place within the United Kingdom.
Feels quite strange standing here in this cairn. It was built in 2014 to honour the United Kingdom, stone by stone. It's kind of strange imagining thousands of people coming here to celebrate the union between Scotland and England, a union that I voted to break up back in 2014. I wonder if its message of strength and unity, does that still resonate today?
I'm going to speak to the cairn's creator, a man who passionately believes that these stones symbolise the bonds of friendship that bind us on both sides of the border.
Have you got the cairn behind you?
Can you see it?
Yeah, great.
Is that?
It's great to see you next to the cairn.
What do you think it means today? What does it stand for today?
At the time when we built it, I felt it was a wonderful way of bringing people together. We had people coming down from the Orkneys, we had people coming up from Cornwall. And at one point, I think we counted that we had almost 100,000 separate stones laid on that cairn. Mm-hmm. So it was a happy experience.
No many happy memories for me, though. I'm pro-Scottish independence, but I do really appreciate the sentiment behind this. So, Ruth, I wanted to ask just about yourself, really. You were born in Hong Kong, raised in Malaysia. Your father's Scottish. What does it mean to you to be Scottish?
For me, being Scottish is rooted in family and soil and landscape. I'm a Stuart. My father's DNA seems to have been hanging around in Scotland for 5,000 years, living on a bit of land that bits of my family were living on 700 years ago. But it's folded into also a pride in what it means to be British. And what it means to be British for me is a country that is confident enough to include difference. I was brought up to believe that the English were a bit boring and the Scottish were more interesting. We were more romantic, that we were brave, that we were curious, but that we were more fun, basically. So somebody like me as a child growing up was, I guess, a gentle kind of Scottish nationalist in the sense that I was deeply proud of Scottish traditions and I would tell anybody who I was at school with, even if I was in Malaysia or England, that I was Scottish, not English. But over time, it began to take on different flavours too. It wasn't just about history. It became increasingly about an argument between the left and the right. And one of the amazing things that Scottish nationalism achieved, and I'm looking at this as a professional politician, is the way that they basically replaced the Labour Party in Scotland and took on a lot of Labour's arguments, which were not really Scottish arguments. They were arguments that could have been made by miners in Durham and somehow made it Scottish, so that all the common interests of workers across borders suddenly was reduced to something that had a border.
I think, you know, Scottish attitudes towards English people are changing. You know, it's, I don't know, a lot of it's kind of pantomime and theatrics. But, like, where do you think the relationship between Scotland and England goes from here?
Understanding, I mean, you had a nice phrase there where you said quite a lot of this is pantomime. I mean, you are a few hundred yards from England. But of course, where you're standing, you can't really tell whether you're in England or Scotland. The sheep are the same, the grass is the same. It's an artificial border. Remembering how much we have in common as humans, I think, is a really, really important. I think the thing that I don't like about nationalism is the idea of division. This is a sort of awkward question, but when you hear somebody like me with what sounds like an English accent saying that they're Scottish, what's your emotional reaction to that?
That's a good question. It's a funny one. I don't know, it's strange. It's like a cat barking.
It's a lovely phrase.
My girlfriend's half English as well, so well, not all bad. Take care.
Bye-bye.
I think Rory was gently tugging at my softer emotional side to try and embrace all that is English, or even half English. Nice try, mate.
A time lapse of cloud cover passing over Edinburgh.
Next, I'm meeting up with a Scots author who doesn't possess an English bone in her body. I don't yous need me to tell yous all about Val McDermid's crime writing success. With more than 16 million books sold worldwide, they're starting to catch up with her body count. I'm here today in Edinburgh to talk to the Queen of Tartan Noir herself, to find out about her journey through growing up Fife, studying at a college in Oxford. I'm keen to find out how she explores identity on the page and hopefully get a few tips from my next book as well. I wasn't too sure where to meet Val, so I decided on the unassuming headquarters of the Royal College of Physicians and their modest little library.
Thanks very much, Val, for coming to talk to me.
That's a pleasure. I take it you brought me to your living room here.
I have, aye, do you like it? I've lovely. Just did it done
very
up.
Nice, right? Yeah. Have you read all these books?
Fife, you grew up in, how did that affect your sense of Scottish identity? Because for me, growing up, like, I always looked at anybody from outside Glasgow as more Scottish.
Well, I think what I had was a very strong sense of Fifeness. I mean, it is the Kingdom of Fife, and it feels different, and that's partly been geographically. It was always an effort to get into Fife or get out of Fife. And my dad was a great Burns man, so I grew up with the idea that, you know, a man's a man for all that, that I should call no man my master, and the only obstacle between me and what I wanted to do was myself.
What kind of sense of the English did you have growing up? Did you even think about them at all?
I felt very distant, really, and very alien. And because I read a lot, I suppose I had this notion of England as a place populated by the famous five and boarding school girls, which was really not my experience of life growing up in Fife.
A photograph of a younger Val sitting at her writing desk.
So you could tell us a wee bit about your journey from Fife to St Hilda's at Oxford.
It was a complete culture shock. Absolutely. When I went for my interview, you know, the principal said to me, "We've never taken anyone from a Scottish state school before."
Wow, great.
And I was, you know, 16 and gallus, and I just said, "Well, it's about time you started." And I think I look back at it now and I break out and I sweat at the absolute brass neck of it.
Did your accent change when you were down south?
My accent had to change. You know, I come from Fife and talk good braid Fife, and nobody kent a word I was saying, Ken. And I realised quite early on that the only thing to do was to learn to speak English. And it was like living in a foreign country. Historically, it was different. Mm-hmm. Politically, it was different. Socially, culturally. English people had a very caricature notion of what Scotland was. They thought we were all like Billy Connolly, and we all lived in tenements and had outside toilets. Years later, I was at a reunion, and one of my cohorts said to me, "We all thought you were so exotic."
Do you think Scottish writers have their nationality overemphasised?
Yeah. You know, people sort of sometimes interviewers say to me, "You talk a lot about being Scottish." It's because you ask a lot about being Scottish. I don't come into the interview going, "By the way, I'm Scottish."
Aye, write that down.
I mean, do you think being Scottish has influenced the way you've approached your work and the way you felt about it?
A wee bit, aye, because at the very start, I was really scared to tell people. I thought my pals will laugh at me and my family will just tell me it's an unreachable dream. You know what I mean?
When I was a teenager, I used to say, "I'm going to be a writer," and everybody would just laugh.
Aye. You know? Do you think it's a Scottish thing?
I think a lot of it is rooted in that sense of folk like us, then you do things like that.
Aye. Up here, do you think we define ourselves too much by our relationship with English?
Yeah, I think there are good historic reasons for doing that. You know, when I was at school, we didn't get taught Scottish history. You know, we got taught British history, which was basically English history. And that inevitably leads to hostility, if you like, towards the people that we feel are expressing superiority over us. And to be fair, you know, most of the English who come here on holiday, for example, come here because they love the country. They want to experience the history and the culture. There's nothing to be hostile about. Just need to get your country back, you know.
That's all we ask for.
Not much.
Chris now steps out of the Royal College of Physicians library.
You ever hear the one about the Englishman, Scotsman and Irishman? Of course you have. We've been taking the piss out of each other for what seems like forever. I'm in Leith to meet comedian Lubna Kerr, Pakistani-born and Pollock Shields-raised, whose kids were born in Wales. I want to ask her about how comedy can underline or undermine stereotypes.
Assalamu alaikum, namaste, sasrikal. And if I didn't say hello in your language, it's probably because it's a place that Britain didn't colonise.
So how did you get into stand-up comedy?
I used to do acting when I was younger, but coming from a Pakistani family, I couldn't have said to my parents I want to be an actress. You know, it would have been easier saying I wanted to join ISIS, it would have been I want to be an actress. So I thought, I'm going to do stand-up comedy.
So have you found that people make assumptions about your identity and your backgrounds?
What do you think?
No.
It's really interesting because it depends on who is asking you. So if it's an Edinburgh person and they'll say to you, "Oh, Lubna,
where are you from? You're not from here, are you?"
And I'm like, "Well, I'm from Edinburgh. I've been here 30 years.
And it's like, "Now, where are you really from?"
"Fine. OK, I was born in Pakistan, but I've lived here all my life."
Aye.
"No, no, Where are you really, really from?
Does he think I'm an alien? Does he think I'm a zombie? Does he think I'm American, you know?
Before I can say anything, he's like, aye, you're from the West. I'm like, no, Pakistan's in the East. He's like, no, you're from Glasgow.
People, when they see you, when they, you know, they make a judgment.
Aye.
So they see your face, they see the colour of your skin. Mm-hmm. Even before you open your mouth, they've made a judgment call. Mm-hmm.
So for you, growing up in Scotland, how did that shape you, do you think?
So I grew up in Pollock Shields in the 70s, which in those days was a very Catholic area. I went to school in Ibrox and I was a Pakistani Muslim kid.
Aye.
You know, so it was very much a mixed identity.
So for your comedy, are you looking to challenge the kind of preconceptions people may have about you?
Oh, absolutely. Because people do like to put you in a box. Mm. And I like to challenge stereotypes all the time. I play myself, but I also have a character called Auntie G. And she's got the tartan scarf on. And people send her letters.
So I got a letter from no other than Nicola Sturgeon. Yes. She was asking for my advice about increasing the amount of exercise that Scottish people do to twice a day. I said to her, Nicola, are you off your bloody head? Scottish people don't even exercise once a week. You increase it to once a day, and now you're saying twice a day. You want to give them a heart attack?
So did you ever feel a kind of sense of an English sentiment in Scotland when you were growing up?
Very much so. I remember one time, it was about the rugby, and, you know, you're singing, you know, Florida, Scotland, the back, and it was that sort of, oh, I hate it, the English. Mm-hmm. There was absolutely no reason to do so, but you just felt... You just felt so strongly about it.
I loved it. I loved hating the English. I took great delight in it. And then you grew up and you grew out of it and you realised, why was I like that? Do you think it's still relevant?
I think it's prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think nationalism plays a big part in that. So my parents were born in India and then during the partition they went over to Pakistan. Because the British, the good old British, love splitting up countries.
Aye, you know? Just drawing lines on maps.
That's right. Yeah. Hong Kong and Aye. Ireland and India. So they sort of had fought for independence.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was growing up, they were very much, why can't Scotland be independent? Because, well, we fought for it, so what's wrong with you guys? You know.
Aye.
But we have to be really careful that we don't create this real break between Aye. Scottish people and English people.
What role do you think comedy could play in kind of healing that divide?
When I do my comedy, they love us.
Aye.
The English people, they love the haggis and they love Gretna and Loch Ness and, you know, they love that. But I think banter is a really good way to heal.
Aye.
Because if you can slag somebody off, it really shows that you love them.
Aye.
I think we can all have a good laugh, can't we?
After the interview, Chris heads out of the comedy club.
It was interesting to hear Lubna speak about her parents' desire for an independent Scotland, in sharp contrast with our own passionate opinions on nationalism and a wish for us Scots not to alienate the English. A reminder, perhaps, of just how complex the debate can be, even within families.
Elsa.
I think there's two tensions for the Union at the moment. You have considerable frustration with the constitutional status quo in Scotland. So national identity hasn't changed, but we certainly know that support for independence is increasing. We have an overwhelming sense of anxiety among the English electorate about devolution, and that manifests itself in particular as frustration with Scotland, frustration with what is perceived to be undue Scottish access to resources, and this notion that they get far more than their fair share and we get less than our fair share. But also, there is a real concern about Scottish influence at the very heart of government. And I think that puts the Union in a really difficult place.
Cross-border migration to England is a long-established feature of us Scots. Recent statistics estimate that over 1 million people born in Scotland are currently living elsewhere in the UK, with over 800,000 of us living in England. That's around a seventh of the current Scottish population.
A steady stream of traffic travels past a pair of concrete water towers painted a bright white.
And during the 20th century, that phenomenon was demonstrated most clearly in the Northamptonshire steelmaking centre of Corby.
Corby stands on the Northamptonshire iron ore fields, and it was to exploit those reserves that the Scottish-based steel, tube and pipe firm Stewarts & Lloyds began to develop Corby in the 1930s.
From the 30s to the 60s, Corby was transformed from an English village into an outpost of Scotland in the heart of the Midlands. Thousands of workers emigrated from places like Glasgow and Aberdeen to work in its vast steel factories, in a town that would become known as Little Scotland.
Corby speaks with a distinctly Scottish voice.
You know, British Steel sent people up to Aberdeen to recruit us, and they took myself and wife down to Corby, wine diners, and put us in hotels. They showed her the town, they showed me the works, and would I like to come? And I said yes. We had a future.
7 hours south of Glasgow, this is Corby town centre. I suppose you could argue that I've not really left Scotland. I mean, this feel a wee bit like East Kilbride or something. Corby's recent history of fading industry is a story shared across many of Scotland's towns and cities.
A decommissioned factory looms in the distance near a public park.
I'm here to meet members of the Grampian Association, a social club which was founded to keep these Scottish links alive. I want to hear more about how they see home and the lives they've made here.
Thanks very much for having me into the Grampian. This is a magic wee place. So what is your links to Scotland? How have you ended up down here?
Well, I came down as a young boy in the late 50s, you know. Mm. And when you come from a two-bedroomed bottom tenement in Fergusley Park to a four-bedroomed semi-detached house, to us it was a revelation coming from where we did.
Mm-hmm. My great-grandparents moved down here to work in the steelworks. Uh-huh. And my family have just been here ever since.
Aye.
My family's from Arbroath. Met my wife here, her family's from Bells Hill.
It's meant that you moved all this way and you meet a lassie from Bells Hill.
I know.
My mother came from Wishaw. Mm-hmm. While she was here, she went into labour early and had me.
Right. So you are Scottish, born in England?
Made in Scotland, born in England.
Yes. You were born in Corby. Yeah. Do you consider yourself Scottish or English?
Scottish.
Why?
Why? Because I was brought up in the Scottish way, so...
Well, everybody was Scottish. That was why it was called Little Scotland.
Aye.
So it was a huge, close-knit community.
On a Saturday market day at the town centre, if you walked through there with your eyes closed, you could be in the middle of Socky Hall Street.
Aye.
You can go to the supermarkets, they've got Scottish food counters, you know, square sausage, black pudding, you know.
And of course, we accept Scottish pound notes down here as well. So you're welcome to spend anything you like while you're here.
Do you think people here are more keen to preserve that kind of Scottish heritage?
Definitely for St Andrew's Night. I have family that come down from Scotland to it.
Wow.
They never have them up there.
We celebrate it down here.
And it's the whole pipe band comes and plays.
Oh, amazing.
And the Highland Dancers put on a display.
Let's try and keep our links to the north of the border.
You said your own wee kind of mock referendum down here, didn't you?
Yes.
What was the outcome of that?
The result was stay.
Aye.
Unified.
Yeah. What was Corby like, you know, when the steel industry was at its peak?
You couldn't hang your washing out on the line on a Monday for the dirt that came from the steelworks, because we lived so close in the Stewarts & Lloyds houses.
You couldn't get away from it. You know, at night you'd be lying in your bed, you'd hear the blast furnaces going.
Right.
It would light up the sky at night.
There used to be a huge, I'm not sure what it was called, but we called it the Corby Candle.
You could see it from miles away. Aye. You knew you were coming home, he said. Aye. You've just left one home, but you're back to this other home, your other home here.
The candle is symbolic to the town, and this candle is under threat.
In May 1979, a devastating hammer blow was dealt to Corby. Margaret Thatcher's newly elected Conservative government announced the closure of the town's steelworks, declaring that too much steel was being produced in Britain, and the Corby works were uncompetitive.
Unemployment is a tragedy, not only for those who are out of a job, but for their families, friends, and for every person who is desperately worried, and rightly, that many who want to work can't.
In total, 11,000 jobs were lost, and the unemployment rate in the area rose to over 30%.
I think it hit very bad, and I think British Steel, at its peak in Corby, employed 12,000 people. Wow. I don't think we've ever really recovered from that.
Do you think Corby's got more in common with like, places in Scotland than it does with places in England?
Scotland's a working-class country. Mm-hmm. There's working-class areas of England that mm-hmm. would have the same issues.
Aye. No, I would like to see a bit more kind of class solidarity, you know, those communities.
It's stereotypes, isn't it? You know, if you go into the heart of Scotland and you say, what is an English person like? They might put on a posh voice or whatever.
That's
if you ask an English monocle, person what a Scottish person's like, they, you know, they put a Hey Jimmy hat on and, you know, it's stereotypes, isn't it, really?
I know.
It's much more complicated than that.
A digger's demolishing a house near a suburb.
So obviously, Corby's changing a lot. Seems to be a lot of new housing estates. It seems like the place is expanding.
Yeah, Corby, one of the fastest growing towns in Britain. Not so long ago, we got a railway station with a line to London.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's making it harder for younger people in Corby because the jobs here aren't as well paying as some of these jobs in London. So these people from London can afford to buy the houses and people from Corby can't.
That's a common enemy, isn't it? It's people from London, they're the real problem. Do you think it'll always be known as Little Scotland? Do you think you can preserve that Scottish identity?
Aye. As long as we're breathing.
Aye.
Very good.
Cheers. I've always felt that we were a wee bit different for the English, but coming to Corby's made me realise that we're really just the same. There's communities down here that are just as hard done by as the schemes back home. I know Corby's been through a bit of a hard time in the last few years, but it sounds as if the future's looking a wee bit brighter.
An overhead view of the town sweeps past derelict factories and abandoned warehouses.
You know your country is mad about football when its cities have more than one club, let alone two in the one street. But let's not go down that route. I'm in Dundee to meet more folk who have plenty to say about our sporting pals, the English, and Scotland's future. But first, I'd like to rewind to some of my early writing.
It's daytime, and Chris is walking down a quiet street.
This wee story I'm about to read is from my first book, Hings. And this story is all about a guy, a Scottish guy, who turns his back on his working class roots in favour of a new middle class lifestyle. But the thing is, I think there is some anti-English sentiment in that, because all the traits I've given Tony to mark him out as the baddie, they're all the traits that I would associate with English, stereotypically. Tony followed his dad through the turnstile. Going to watch Partick Thistle had been their routine every other Saturday for years until Tony gave it up to spend his weekends golfing with Greg or visiting farmers markets with Kate, hunting for the best organic produce the West End of Glasgow had to offer. Ah, it's good to have you back at the games with me, son. It really is. Or come out of your arseholes when you're lazy shower of shite. You don't have to behave like a hooligan, Dad. After Thistle scored to go 1-0 up, a couple of young guys a few seats in front let off a flare. Well, for goodness sake, Tony said, he started letting out a series of pathetic wee coughs. Oh, lighten up, you. You can't just... Oh, for fuck's sake, Dylan, I couldn't have scored that. I could murder a pie, Tony's dad said as he dried his hands. I don't even want to think about what they put in those pies, replied Tony. Back in their seats, though, Tony had begun to loosen up and enjoy himself. He even leapt in the air to celebrate the third goal, much to the disapproval of the two men in suits behind him. Middle-class toss there behind us, eh, Dad? Fucking pot kettle, son. What? Tony changed his accent. I'm not a toff. You fucking up, pal. I hate to be the man to break it to you. Tony realised he was, in fact, a stuck-up snobby bastard. The change had been so gradual that he hadn't seen it coming. Oh, well, this is who he was now, and it was better than being some schemy waster.
A bird's-eye view rises away from the city streets and then looks out across the urban sprawl.
Writing in Scots is important to me. It's just what comes naturally and I feel most comfortable with. Next, I'm meeting one of my personal heroes, Billy Kay, a writer and broadcaster who uses the mother tongue to express his own view of the world. And to bring some historical context to my journey, Billy has brought along some choice literary examples of how our relationship with English has been immortalised in print throughout the centuries.
This is from the Complaint of Scotland, the middle of the 16th century. English men are hummel when they are subjected by force and violence, and Scottish men are furious when they are violently subjected. English men are cruel when they get victory, and Scottish men are merciful when they get victory. And to conclude, it's impossible that Scottish men and English men can remain in concord under yin monarch because their natures and conditions are as indifferent as is the nature of sheep and wolves. So, powerful wee statement.
That's good, that.
I read Hings and I was fascinated by your use of the language. Is it something that came to you easily?
When I first sat down to write, that's just what came out. I just found it easy to write the way I talk. I kind of thought, I want to read stuff that's written in my language, kind of Glaswegian Scots. Yeah. So why don't I write it? So how important is speaking and writing Scots to you and your Scottish identity?
It's the core of my being. I can never be anything else. I'm Scots in language, I'm Scots in philosophy, I'm Scots in politics. I'm Scots in my heart and my soul.
Aye.
I grew up speaking a broad dialect of Ayrshire Scots 90% of the time. My culture had roots going back to Burns's time. And so when I studied Scots and Scottish literature, my immediate reaction was, why don't I know this already? If we cease to be able to understand Scots, we cease to be able to read our history, for example, and read our literature.
So obviously, as Scots, we've got a long history of getting out into the world. And what is it about us, do you think, that drove that?
It was an international outlook. People who think of Scotland as a provincial backwater of England or Britain have no idea the impact their country has had globally on the world.
Aye, absolutely.
Scots were precocious in their desire for mass literacy at a time when other countries would take several centuries to catch up on that. And that's why they did so well. So for about 150 years, Europe was enthralled to Scottish culture. Wow. From the poems of Ossian and the novels of Walter Scott and Robert Burns through to the brilliance of the Scottish Enlightenment. David Hume, the great philosopher, he compares being lionised in Paris and the animosity that he experienced in English intellectual circles. It was as if because he was a Scot, they couldn't accept that he could be a genius. And he says, in England, some hate me because I'm not a Tory, some because I'm not a Whig, some because I'm not a Christian, and all because I am a Scotsman.
Given how successful Scots have been over the centuries, do you think we define ourselves too much by our relationship with English?
I would say we do, but that's because we haven't been educated in our own culture. Robert Bonteen Cunningham Graham founded the Labour Party in Scotland with Keir Hardie and then decided he would go a bit further and was one of the founding fathers of the SNP in the 1930s. He was quite anglicised, but there's a great quote by him and it goes something like, "The enemies of Scottish nationalism are not the English, for they were ever a noble people quick to respond when justice calls. Our enemies are here among us, born without imagination."
Chris now walks out of the bar, his hands buried in his pockets.
Something I've always been interested in is how Scotland sees itself. Are we always going to be in the shadow of our larger neighbour? Personally, I see us being confident and noticed for our achievements, not just nationally, but internationally too. I'm heading to meet Tayside-born Leonie Bell, one of Scotland's most experienced cultural leaders. Leonie kicked off her career with the Glasgow 1999 UK City of Architecture and Design.
It now gives me the greatest pleasure to declare the 20th Commonwealth Games open.
And her passion for design has been rewarded with high-profile roles. She led the cultural programmes for the Glasgow 2014 Commonwealth Games and the 2012 London Olympics. Now in her new job as the director of the V&A, I want to chat to her about how Scotland's relationship with the arts is changing.
Beautiful building.
Thank
you. First time up here. So your dad's English, your mum's Scottish.
My dad's really English, like everything, loves cricket, brought up Radio 4 in the background. Parents both spoke and received pronunciation, so I don't think I had a really massive idea of what being Scottish maybe was until I left to go to Glasgow.
So you were away in Glasgow for 27 years. What was it like coming back to Dundee?
Amazing. I'd forgotten how beautiful Dundee is. I'd forgotten how beautiful the sky is and the river and when the plaza's brimming with people. And like, I feel like I could be anywhere in Europe. And it just is. It just makes my heart like skip a beat because I think we can stand there with the best cities and countries. And I just, that's exciting. And that kind of brought me back that the city that's quite small was just so bold in its ambition.
I think in the past, a lot of Scots felt like they had to move away from Scotland to kind of make something of themselves, and they're always really outward-looking. But it's nice to see, I feel like loads of Scottish people feel like we can achieve what we want and kind of make the changes that we want to see in this country.
I never wanted to leave Scotland. There was maybe a point in my early 20s where I thought, do I go to London? Like, everybody maybe has that, is London where I need to be valid? Mm-hmm. And I kind of just kept thinking, why? I love it here. And the cultural and artistic community of Scotland's just, I think, just so amazing. It's kept me stimulated, and I've just continually learned by working as part of it.
Has being the director here changed how you see or how you feel about Dundee?
It has, because I'm thinking a lot about what's the role of a museum mm-hmm. and a design centre like this in the life of a city. You know, there's deep-rooted inequality, there's massive challenges with job opportunities and all of those things, and the addiction challenges that Dundee has are known. So thinking really hard about what a museum does around all of those is really, really interesting. So I think I'm seeing the city in more depth than I ever, ever have, and I feel a sense of responsibility alongside many other people for making sure that, or to help, just to help Dundee, you know.
Do you feel there's ever a sense that some Scottish people think that the English are coming in and taking the kind of top jobs in the arts?
I don't know if it's just about the English. I think people are uncomfortable in private school and state school, class and opportunity and privilege that all comes together.
I've got a theory, right?
I'd love to hear your theory.
So I think we've got a wee bit of an inferiority complex to the English. When I was a wee boy, it was almost jarring when a Scottish person appeared on the telly. And I wonder if maybe that leads us to think, maybe that's not for us, maybe we're not meant to do that.
If you're surrounded by role models that are writers and artists and architects, mm-hmm. as a young person, I think you think, I can do that, that can be me. But if you don't see what yourself represented in those things, I think it's really difficult, and we've got to change that. So I think people being able to speak in their own accent and dialect and language and write in it, and that being totally normalised is so, so important. So yeah, there's still work to do.
I know.
But you're doing it, which is brilliant. The sense of identity has totally changed as I've got older and as Scotland's asked big questions of itself. I love the sense of kind of youthful possibility about V&A Dundee, even though we're attached to an organisation that's, you know, a century and a bit old. I am so proud to be Scottish.
From the Tay Road Bridge, spanning the Firth of Tay, to Chris driving along a Highland road in the shadow of nearby mountains.
Next on my journey, I'm travelling a couple of hundred miles to Gerlock in the far northwest of Scotland. Maybe in the past I did sometimes consider the English as an alien species or think of England as a foreign land. But to be honest, right now driving through this remote landscape in my own country, it's beginning to give me similar thoughts.
So it's something with a postcard, isn't it? The furthest I normally venture for Glasgow is like Loch Lomond and that kind of thing. And that's nice, but this is something else. Feels good for you, good for the soul, as they say. Proud of being Scottish, but I've never really felt that kind of deep connection to the land or something. But when you're here and you're just starting to take all this in, it I don't know, it kind of rouses something inside you. Sounds a bit cheesy, but you know what I mean.
He now drives along a single road, winding through the base of a valley.
I'm on my way to meet Mark Littlejohn, an ex-policeman turned award-winning photographer whose hobby became a career when he won Landscape Photographer of the Year back in 2014 for this image of Glencoe.
2014, you won that?
I'd only been doing photography for 4 years. And funnily enough, people talk about pictures that they take just for awards. And I've never really felt that way. It's the case of you take your own pictures. I mean, if they like it, they like it. If they don't, they can bugger off.
Aye. Is that a bit of rain heading away from over the horizon?
Depends what you mean by a bit.
Looking forward to this now.
Yeah, there's really waterproof in it.
Mark comes from Edinburgh originally, but spent almost four decades working in England for the CID in Penrith. He then retired to become a guide on the Ullswater steamers in the Lake District.
It's a weird sort of thing. When I lived in the lakes, it was always manicured, if you like. Up here, it's still wild, it's untamed. Mm-hmm. It's primordial, elemental, call it what you will. But you can almost see the rocks that were formed millions of years ago. And it's just got a different feel to it.
So you fancy doing the last wee bit?
OK, I'm on then. We've made it all this way.
Being Scottish, I came back up here years and years ago, and I just felt like home.
Aye.
So this is it? This is why you moved up here, then?
So it's not boring, it's not grey skies. They are grey, but there's a multitude of greys. I'm not going to say 50 shades of grey.
I'm curious to find out more about Mark's earlier career working down south, but first, I think I'd quite like to get in out of the cold.
So what's it like living and working in England as a Scottish person?
Intriguing. I think the attitudes have changed a little bit. When I first went down there, 1981, a lot of Mickey taken. Some folk you could tell were actually like, what have you come down here for? And I always used to give the stock answer that, oh, I come down here because competition was easier. But I mean, one of the old boys was broad Scottish, and he says, don't lose your accent, son.
Aye.
And if you're broad Scottish, they still somehow thought that you were slightly harder than they were, which was true, obviously, but it just sort of reinforced the fact.
So you worked on the Ullswater steamers, and that's kind of ferrying tourists about, aye?
I was in the police for 30 years, CID for 25, and in some occasions I didn't dislike the public so much until I started working in tourism.
Aye.
Because there's some of the entitled attitudes of people. They would treat you as something just to snap the fingers at.
Aye.
You didn't have to say please, you didn't have to say thank yous. And it seems to be just the way it was going. The lakes was turning into a theme park for the wealthy.
Is that to do with them buying up property and stuff like that?
Buying up property. So how do you expect communities to carry on going when that happens?
Aye. So you've moved up here and you're kind of seeing this happening with the holiday homes and stuff?
I mean, at the end of the day, it could be said by others that I'm doing exactly what's happened down country. It'd be great if there was some sort of way that we could keep younger people here and in the lakes and provide homes for them and give them a sense of ownership and not a sense that they're being pushed out, because it does change the attitudes of people.
That kind of thing happening up here, do you think it impacts on their kind of their sense of Scottishness?
I think it's going to be inclined to make you feel more Scottish.
Aye.
You know what we're like as Scottish? Give us a sense of injustice. And we're there, shouting freedom and all that sort of carry on.
What does it mean to you to be Scottish?
Chings.
I know it's a bit of a difficult one.
I've never really thought about it before, to be honest. Being Scottish to me is more about loving your neighbour, about being decent, about being welcoming, about living to decent standards and values, not putting pounds first, but putting people first. That to me is Scottish.
Soft pink hues now colour the dusk sky over the Highlands.
Well, I'm nearly at the end of my journey. I've met folk from both sides of the border along the way, and one question I put to them all was where they saw the future of the Scottish-English relationship.
In the immediate future, I can see a big divide when it does come to the time where there is a vote for independence.
We need to learn from history and kind of go, you know, being at each other's throats, having that animosity. Yes, there's validity to it, but actually we need to move past that now.
I would like to hope in my lifetime that the union stays there.
I think we need to just hold hands
across Hadrian's Wall.
I just hope for equality, to have good neighbours.
I'd love to think that the relationship stays strong and it stays a loving one, if you like, between the people. But unfortunately, the way things have been done from England, I'm not entirely sure if that's going to be how it ends up.
There's undoubtedly been a democratic deficit for the last 50 years, that Scotland has not got the governments it voted for. These things do feed into that sense of, you know, this isn't fair. This is captivity.
Now we've got a wee bit of Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah.
an aerial view of a vast forest, then a shallow stream washing over a bed of overlapping rocks.
My final stop is here, on the banks of the River Esk, just a few miles north of Carlisle, in the Debatable Lands, right on the divide between England and Scotland. For centuries, pockets of this landscape were fought over by Scots and English armies, as well as by lawless border reivers, with each group intent on claiming the land as their own. And just like these lands have been up for debate, what the Anglo-Scottish relationship looks like will almost always be contested.
It seems to me like we're maybe never going to escape talking about the English and the comparisons for better and for worse between each other. There's just too much shared history and blood.
Chris steps away from the watchtower railing before making his way back down the spiral stone staircase. He's now standing in the car park, opening his red notebook.
The English, my pal says to me. They bastards. Arrogant, rude and entitled, every single one of them. See, out of curiosity, I say, what do you think about people from Newcastle? Aye, well, they're basically Scottish, aren't they? Well, no, mate, they're English. Aye, but they're all right. What do you think about people from Liverpool then, or Manchester? Aye, they seem all right as well, I suppose. What do you think about people from London? Oh, what beside a couple of guys from London. They're quite sound. So you're saying that you hate the English, but you like all the people from the places I've just mentioned? They're all pure stuck up, aren't they, and snobby and posh. Are the English people you know like that? Oh, well, no, actually. But you do hate posh, rich, stuck up, snobby people. Aye. What if they're Scottish? Aye, I'd still hate them, especially if they're from Edinburgh. You don't hate the English, mate. I think it's something else. I think you hate the elite, the people at the top. Oh. Maybe that's what it is. How do we even end up talking about them anyway? I've no idea. Always seems to happen, doesn't it? Look, let's not talk about the English. I think we've done quite enough of that.
After closing his notebook, Chris paces across the car park away from the watchtower. Two Scottish flags and a single Union Jack lie limp on separate flagpoles nearby, softly rustling in the mild breeze.